Lord, help us all to take great courage because you are with us and you are for us forever. Amen. I have, probably like you, heard people preach about Jesus walking on water and Peter's response many times, some good and some not so good. As I've been preparing and praying this week, I've been asking, God, what is distinctive or what's something different that I can bring? How, Lord, can I interpret this passage faithfully? In most of the Gospels, whenever Jesus sends the disciples to cross the lake, he's about to do something or to tell them something that will help them cross to a new level of faith. He's not just talking about crossing the lake, but about crossing boundaries of understanding. My hope today is that we all cross a boundary of understanding and come to know Jesus and his call on our lives in a new way. So the context of our gospel is that Jesus has just fed the 5,000, as we heard last week. And then Matthew writes that immediately Jesus got the disciples to get into a boat. What sort of boat, you ask? Well, if you allow me to just nerd out a little bit, I can tell you. In 1986, on the western shoreline of the Sea of Galilee, there had been a drought and the sea had dropped, and then they found submerged in the mud the remains of a first century Jewish fishing boat. So they determined that a fishing boat of this era was about 8.5 metres long and 2.5 metres wide and not very deep at all. At a squish, it would fit 12 to 13 people without any gear. So we know that it's a pretty full boat that Jesus has told the disciples to go over to the other side. And actually, the over the other side wasn't very far away at all. From the plains of Bethsaida, where the fish sandwich party had taken place, to the opposite side, it should have taken them about 2 hours to sail over to. Jesus, meanwhile, takes himself up a mountainside to pray, to take time out and to care for himself. I love the word immediately, which occurs frequently in our text, and I wonder if it's a bit like when my kids were young and I desperately needed a second to myself. So when Locke would get home from work, I would meet him in the driveway with our dog to go for a jog, saying, "Tag, you're it." So Jesus shooes the disciples immediately because he knows he needs to take time out for himself, perhaps. But the wind was against them. So instead of crossing to the other side, they are blown into the middle of the lake. There is a well-known northeasterly wind called Shakia, a pummeling wind that can push you out into the Sea of Galilee. So the fourth watch comes, which is between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m., and Jesus comes to them, walking on water. I wonder if Jesus had been watching from his mountain point, because on clear nights, I have read, that you can see the entire Sea of Galilee if there's enough moonlight. And yet Jesus stayed put. He didn't panic. He chose to be fully present in his space and time alone. We can't jump for every storm and embody self-care too. So our disciples are exhausted. They have been rowing against the Shakia that has been building up through the night. The wind and the waves have intensified and they are far from land, struggling against the turbulent water. They are terrified and say they can see a ghost. Jesus hasn't walked on water before. Maybe their first response is not excitement but fear, because we are used to the predictable. When God does anything unpredictable, we get afraid. And they are also terrified because they are contending with deep, ancient fear. Fear of the unknown, fear of suffering, fear of death. And the disciples are not wrong to be afraid. Of course they're scared. They're in a dodgy boat by our standards. There's no life jackets here. They're afraid because giant, gigantic waves in the middle of the night are scary. They're so scared because they lack the tools to process what they see. Humans can't walk on water. I wonder if Jesus looks like a ghost because the Jesus that the disciples left on the other side of the sea looked overworked, fatigued, and unsteady, perhaps. Perhaps they were not accustomed to seeing Jesus look so rested, in control and peaceful. Thus, they thought he was a ghost. Bell Hooks, an American academic known for writings on race, feminism and class, in her book Sisters of the Yam, states that self-care is a political act of resistance for black women. Self-care might be a political act of resistance for anyone. Overwhelmed by challenges caused by the superwoman or superman syndrome, or by the perennial onslaught of sexism, racism, classism, heterosexism, disability, or any other form of oppression. Because we know that after his time of self-care, after his spirit, mind, and body were rejuvenated, Jesus was empowered from his head to the sole of his water-walking feet and at the fringe of his garment. At the end of our gospel reading, we are told that when Jesus reaches land, he doesn't have to do all the heavy lifting. The people empower themselves and are healed by merely touching the hem of his cloak, something that hadn't happened since the early part of his ministry. So Jesus tells the disciples, "Take courage, it is I, do not be afraid." The phrase, "it is I," is literally from the Greek ego eimi, which means I am. Jesus says, "Take courage, I am." Here and elsewhere in the Gospels, this simple designation powerfully connects Jesus to the Yahweh of Israel. When Moses asks God in the burning bush for his name, God says his name is I Am. Yahweh is the great I Am. And Jesus connects himself to this very same God more than once. Jesus is God. And that's why his presence gives us cause to take courage and in turn to not be afraid. Jesus doesn't calm the storm. He doesn't make the waves and winds stop then, but he shows up. God shows up, the one who has countless times before, all through history, mastered storms like this one. Back to our men in the boat. The issue is not their fear. The issue is where fear leads. Notice the first place that Peter's fear leads him. He has every right to be afraid when his boat pitches in the dark sea. Feeling scared in the face of danger is not the problem. The problem is that his fear leads him straight to suspicion and distrust. His fear leads him to test and question Jesus' identity instead of taking Jesus' self-disclosure at face value. If it's you, enable me to do the impossible. If it's you, make magic happen so that I will be dazzled out of all doubt. If it's you, reorder reality and prove to me that you're God. Peter's actions in this story I recognize so well. Like Peter, I fail to recognize Jesus when the going gets rough. When I face fearsome circumstances, my go-to position is not trust, it's suspicion. In my fear, I forget that my relationship with God is multifaceted and complex, and I reduce it to something crassly transactional. Okay, Jesus, prove that you care about me. I'll do A, and you'd better do B in return. As far as we know, 11 of the disciples say nothing. Those disciples stayed in the boat, pulling on their oars against the wind and steering their way toward Jesus so that he could do no more than just get on board with the rest of them. Even if this story is about what some have preached, the need to do heroic and dramatic acts of stepping out on faith, even so, there is something to be said about faithful, low-key, non-dramatic work in the boat too. There's something to be said for just believing the power of Jesus' words when he claims we need not fear because he is the great I am. But Peter, brash, impetuous, over-the-top Peter, proposes this bizarre test to prove the would-be ghost's identity. "Lord, if it's you, tell me to come to you on the water." Jesus says, "Come," and Peter steps out of the boat. Now, Peter has a brother in the boat, Andrew, who says nothing. I have a brother. And if my brother got out of a boat in a storm to try to walk on water, which I'm pretty sure has never happened before, I would be speaking up. But Andrew is saying nothing. Maybe he's thinking, far out, my bro's mouth is always getting him into trouble. Let's see how this one plays out. For one luminous second, or two, or ten, Peter walks on the water towards Jesus. What would possess Peter to believe he could walk on water? We need to remember that the goal of a disciple wasn't to know what the rabbi knew, it was to be who the rabbi was. Maybe Peter wants to be just like his rabbi and is willing to die to be like him. Yesterday at our Mary Magdalene breakfast, we heard a wonderful talk from Lynette Glendinning on lessons on leadership for women. She encouraged women not to wait until we are fully competent or confident to walk through a door that has opened, because the space will be filled by those who are halfway competent anyway. She called us to step out in faith. But then Peter realizes what he's doing. He notices the vicious wind, the rising waves and the dark water, and fear overwhelms him. He begins to drown. And we all know a little of what fear can do to us. It causes us to freeze, to panic, and to doubt. What if I offend someone? What if they don't like me? What if I can't make a difference? Who do you think you are, Wendy? We are all drowning, trying to live up to expectations. We fear disappointing people. We fear we won't have enough. We fear that we'll make the wrong decision. And of course we feel afraid as we face climbing interest rates, increasing cost of living, social isolation, and political brokenness. Of course we feel afraid when unhealthy relationships, sick spouses, unfriendly neighbours, grinding jobs, and the aftermath of pandemics threaten our lives. Of course we feel afraid when our basic biology portrays us with anxiety, panic, and depression. We live in a culture surrounded by fear. Many institutions thrive, even profit, on our fear and scarcity mindset. The media, health industry, politicians, and regrettably, even some forms of institutionalized religion. We all know what it means to fear. And we can all relate with Peter, because the truth is, in some way, each of us is sinking. "Lord, save me," Peter cries. Immediately, Jesus reaches out his hand, catches Peter, and delivers him to safety. I wonder if you too have felt Jesus reach out his hand to catch you when you were terrified and were sure that you would drown. Maybe you haven't recognized it because that hand came wearing different disguises. A flash of light in the middle of a routine spiritual practice, a moment of unexplainable peace when waiting for a loved one's tumor to be resected, and often it shows up in the community, in the love of family and friends. "You of little faith," Jesus says to the breathless, sopping Peter once the worst of the danger is over, "why did you doubt?" We never hear Peter's answer, if he manages to offer one. On the face of it, this story might appear to reinforce a fear not version of Christianity, and I've certainly heard sermons declare as much. See, Peter can do the impossible when he exercises bold, fearless faith in Jesus. His faith empowers him to walk on water, just like Jesus. But as soon as Peter gives in to fear and doubts Jesus, he nearly drowns. But nowhere in the Gospels are we called to prove our faith or test God's character by taking pointless risks threatening our lives. Nowhere in the Gospel does Jesus teach us that bad things happen to us because we're too chicken to earn God's protective care. Whether we're talking about respecting the power of the sea during a vicious storm or heeding expert medical advice during a global pandemic, the same caution applies. Recklessness is not faith. Stupidity is not courage. But who is Jesus talking about when he says, "Why did you doubt?" Is Peter doubting Jesus? But Jesus isn't sinking. There is absolutely room for doubt in faith. As we have heard many times from this pulpit, doubt is welcome here. Doubt keeps faith alive. And I love this quote. As Henri Nouwen says, "Doubts are the ants in the pants of faith. They keep it awake and moving." No, Jesus is saying, "Why do you doubt yourself?" Jesus is doing just fine standing there. Jesus believes in Peter more than Peter believes in himself. As soon as we start looking at ourselves, "What's wrong with me? Why am I not good enough, smart enough?" we will always lose faith. The secret is keeping our eyes on Jesus. For women who have doors open before us, may be feeling unconfident, wanting to wait till we're 100% competent, doubting ourselves, Lynette reminded us yesterday to act in faith, knowing that the Holy Spirit is with you. There is a Jewish saying that I like about belief in God. That is, before you teach a child to believe in God, teach the child that God believes in them. When someone believes in you, it changes things, gives you hope, courage, confidence to do what needs to be done. Jesus is saying, why are you doubting? Why don't you have as much faith in yourself as I do? Jesus believes in Peter and you and me more than we believe in ourselves. As soon as Peter and Jesus climb into the boat, the wind dies down, the sea grows still and calm, and the disciples recognize Jesus for who and what he is. Truly, they say, in awe, you are the Son of God. The disciples, all of them, recognize Jesus in some way that they hadn't before. They have an epiphany, they worship. Matthew says they find themselves on their knees with gratitude, recognition, and awe. As Barbara Brown Taylor said in a sermon, if there is a miracle worth savoring in this story, then it's maybe not that Jesus could walk on water. After all, if Jesus is God, then his ability to walk on water is no more surprising than my ability to walk up a flight of stairs. And the miracle is not that Peter managed the same trick for a moment or two. No, the miracle is that when all is said and done, while a soggy and chagrined Peter sputtered seawater out of his lungs, and as the boat continued to bob around in the dead of that rather dark night, somehow, amid those humble surroundings, way out there in the middle of nowhere, the disciples realized that no one less than God's own Son was sitting right in front of them. So they worshipped and they believed. Notice that Jesus doesn't tell his disciples to stop asking questions when he gets in the boat. He doesn't tell them to abandon inquiry, lament, or struggle. He doesn't chastise Peter for taking the risk and climbing out of the boat into the thick of it. He simply reminds him and asks, I am here, do not be afraid. There is one that is for us, even more than we are for ourselves. Jesus is present, even in the chaos, even in the storm, believing in us. They land at Gennesaret because the boat is not a place to stay. God wants much more for them and for us than safety and stability. Our community here at Holy Covenant needs both visionary and courageous folks who step out in faith to do new and bold things, who are willing to listen and to be curious about what the Spirit is doing in our neighbourhood. But we also need folks who are faithfully pulling on their oars against the winds that howl, believing that Jesus is near and pressing on. Jesus believes that we can live Christ-emulating lives. He has faith in us to bring his kingdom to the neighbourhood. Do we? Can we commit to and support this vision here? If we look at the entire flow of Matthew, it will help us to grasp what is important here, I think. Matthew 1 begins with saying they will call him Emmanuel, God with us. And Matthew ends with, and surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. God is always with us, believing in us. Look at Peter. Jesus is constantly about the business of restoring and reinstating Peter to ministry. After the abortive water walk, after the whole get thee behind me thing, after the three-time denial, Jesus still believes in Peter and in us. The power of this gospel story doesn't lie in Peter's faith, doubt, courage, or fear. Peter's trajectory, interesting though it is not the point of the reading. Jesus's trajectory is the point, because unlike Peter's, it never changes. It is constant, focused, relentless, and unidirectional. From the very beginning of the story, Jesus moves towards his disciples. He moves towards them when they're struggling at sea. He moves towards them when they decide he's a menacing ghost. He moves towards them when they're terrified by his approach. He moves towards them when they're reckless enough to set him a dare. He moves towards them when they begin to drown. He moves towards them when they ask for help. He moves towards them when they're shivering and sorry for their rashness. He moves towards them when they realize, for a beautiful, flickering instant, who he is and what he is. He moves towards them when they worship him. In other words, Jesus never stops moving towards the ones he loves. He never stops coming and crossing the dark water to come to where we are. Neither our fearfulness nor our faithlessness in our abilities to emulate him ever alters his steady approach. We are the ones that he is bound for. Our flailing bodies are the ones he pulls out of the water. Ours is the boat he climbs into. It is for us that he calls across the terrifying waters, again and again and again. Take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid.